Right now it's overcast, wind from the northwest at 15, gusting to 28, 41 degrees Kenosha, 39 for Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to once again welcome into our studios Dr. Art Sear, who has been a monthly visitor to the morning show for more than two decades, always here to offer his expertise and his perspective on a wide array of current events and issues and concerns, and more often than not offers a perspective that might be a bit different, a bit distinct from the predominant sort of story that plays out in mainstream media. And so it's always great to have kind of a refreshing look on various concerns. Dr. Sear is someone who is well known for the column that he writes that is published in newspapers all across the country, and he is also the author of the book After the Cold War. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you for inviting me back. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you for such a warm welcome on a cold morning, as the cow said to the farmer in Wisconsin.
Yes, Wisconsin.
Thank you for laughing.
Yes. Yeah. Wisconsin feels like Wisconsin today, that is for sure. So there's quite a lot to talk about. As I surveyed your last four columns, you touched on four distinct and all really important matters. And so I'm glad we can have a chance to explore all of them. I do want to begin with the matter of tariffs, the tariffs championed by President Trump as he moves into his second term, tariffs that he has championed and then at certain points pulled back upon. So it's a little hard to know just what these tariffs will ultimately look like in final form. But one of the things that I appreciated about your column on the topic was giving us, as you so often do, more of a historical long view on what is going on. And you say early in this particular column, President Trump's tariff moves are distinctively dramatic, but are part of a longer-term trend. So in other words, although they might in some ways, because they are so dramatic and in a sense so aggressive, they might seem like they're kind of coming out of nowhere, and that's actually not exactly true. Talk about this longer-term trend that these tariffs put forward by President Trump are a part of.
We had quite a remarkable history of bipartisan support for reducing trade barriers, free trade. It reflects the selflessness and farsightedness of our leaders, especially in the Roosevelt, Truman, and in particular the Eisenhower administration. The consensus started clearly to break apart in the late 1980s. The Uruguay round was the last of a series of comprehensive free trade agreements spearheaded by the United States government that we were able to negotiate successfully. The successor Doha, D-O-H-A round, has been stymied mainly because of the European Union and African nations being at loggerheads over agricultural products. The Obama administration was probably the high watermark of internationalist sentiment, and President Obama and associates, to their credit, in my opinion, negotiated in preliminary terms the Trans-Pacific Partnership and a less well-known complementary Atlantic Area Free Trade Agreement. They were never really confirmed. They were never passed. And Hillary Clinton very publicly broke with the Obama administration, followed by other Democrats in the 2016 campaign. So Trump, he's got his own distinctive style, but he reflects broader sentiments and broader trends in this country that are quite significant and quite historic.
Are you saying that that process of tilting in this direction in some ways began with Hillary Clinton? Not began, I don't mean like originated, she was part of that.
I don't think she was a particularly strong candidate. I don't think she initiated anything. But she, like other politicians, she reflected trends that are very important.
So, and I only mention her, so what you're saying is President Trump and Hillary Clinton in this relatively rare instance would be in some respects on the same page. Not that she would necessarily favor exactly what he's doing, but they are part of a continuum towards this.
Yeah, historically, the Democratic Party, going back to Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, the Democratic Party was the free trade party, thanks primarily to its agricultural roots, in contrast to the industrializing North and East. The protectionist sentiment was concentrated in the Federalists and Whigs and the Republicans. Abraham Lincoln was a very strict protectionist because, following Alexander Hamilton, the consensus was we need to protect ourselves, especially from Great Britain and the British Empire and the British fleet. We've got to stay isolationist, and we've got to protect what were called infant industries. Thanks to Dwight Eisenhower, the great magician, he transformed the Republican Party without ever publicly appearing to be doing that or much of anything else, but into a free trade and internationalist party. And on balance, today, the Republicans are, in fact, more contrary to Trump's posturing and monopoly of the media stage. the Republican Party is on balance more free trade than the Democrats. Union sentiment has become increasingly strong, and agrarian sentiment weaker and weaker on the Democratic side.
Right.
Farmers are seen nowadays as Republicans, and there's a lot of truth to that. But in point of fact, the farm vote was always up for grabs. Mm.
Your column about this details some of these previous free trade agreements, and I knew next to nothing about any of these, so it was really interesting reading about something called the Dillon Round, and then the Kennedy Round, and the Tokyo Round, and the Uruguay Round, and I suspect that the average American probably is largely unaware of some of these negotiations, although typically people have certainly heard of things like NAFTA and so on. I don't remember if it was NAFTA or another major free trade agreement, but I remember the fanfare that surrounded, if I remember correctly, all of the living presidents, so former presidents, coming together as a gesture of support for whatever this free trade agreement on the table was. I mean, and Democrats and Republicans both. And it was kind of an extraordinary sight. And even back then, when it was not the divisive times we are in now to the same extent, but I mean, it was just pretty remarkable. And you wondered what would be an issue that would draw former Democratic and Republican presidents together and say, we all support this. And it was free trade.
Mm-hmm.
But now is the thought that in some quarters that we have gone too far with this thing called free trade?
Obviously, yes. There's, you make a very important point. I make it very well. There was a broad consensus that has broken down. We have full employment in our economy. I was just listening to NPR on the long commute up this morning, and we have full employment and then some in Wisconsin. There are jobs crying to be filled.
Yeah,
as more and more old people like me retire. All across the board. But there's also tremendous disruption that's accompanied the modern economy, keeping things local. You used to be able to, a man or a woman could graduate from high school before World War II, just the eighth grade, if that, and get a line job at the local Chrysler plant or another auto assembly plant. Kenosha was the mecca for that industry, as a lot of our listeners know. And you'd have a job for life with great benefits thanks to the United Auto Workers Union, a very progressive, very in the best sense, very powerful and very honest union. That's all changed. And while you can find a job, I think the insecurity and disruption that's defined life, especially in the Midwest, for an awful lot of people who worked in traditional industries. Now, the common refrain, including from the President of the United States, is, well, these jobs were stolen from us, and your job has been taken to China, or your job was moved to Mexico. In very few cases was that literally true. In point of fact, those jobs are disappearing thanks to automation.
They aren't anywhere, in other words.
Exactly, a machine has replaced what used to be extensive assembly line labor and machinery. Modern aircraft, for instance, to a significant degree, they are entirely machine produced. And part of the, I think, overdone mania, certainly the hype connected with artificial intelligence, is a result of broad public awareness that these changes are tremendously disruptive. Those jobs aren't around anymore. One of my favorite facts, mainly to get the point across to students or try to, is that in 1900, half the population lived on farms.
Wow.
And we were in 1900, we were a very, very powerful agricultural exporter and importer. We are still the world's largest agricultural exporter and importer, but we only have one or two. We're producing vastly more than we produced in 1900, but we only have 1 or 2% of the population on farms, and a similar process is going on in industry. But industrial workers are more urban, and they're not necessarily more well-organized, but they're generally less conservative than the traditional farm population. And so they're making their voices heard. Trump quite brilliantly seized on that and has literally transformed the Republican Party from a party heavily representing more educated people and the professional classes to a blue-collar party. In effect, the Republican Party is currently replacing the Democratic Party in that regard. Quite a profound change.
Yeah. So depending on what sort of ends up being resolved with these tariffs, I mean, you know, with certain dramatic proposals, many of which the president has kind of pulled back on or extended delays before they are implemented and so on. But ultimately, when all of this kind of shakes out in some ways, what is sort of the means of protection? If we call this part of a growing trend of protectionism, what are we protecting ourselves from? And what exactly are the means? I mean, in what way are tariffs a tool to protect ourselves from whatever it is we need protecting from?
Well, I don't think it's a rational process. It's not, I'm very, very fortunate in life. I've been employed from a very young age. I've been able to get a paycheck. I don't ever minimize the good fortune that I've enjoyed and others have enjoyed. I've emphasized that in particular to my children over many years. What we're trying to protect ourselves from is fear, a la FDR's first inaugural. No, people are afraid. They're anxious, afraid especially of the unknown. We're not protecting ourselves from the evil enemy overseas. Free trade especially, ironically, helps working people. People whose a much larger percentage of whose income goes for food, clothing, furniture, utilities, transportation. Those are the kinds of costs that are going to be really hit hard. The rich people are going to stay rich, and big corporations know how to deal with challenges and anticipate them. But working people are really going to get clobbered, I think, by higher prices. On the other hand, we are so rich. We are so unbelievably wealthy by any historical standard.
We as a nation.
Yes, but also the West and the industrialized nations generally. And I certainly include Japan and in some ways even more so South Korea. And several hundred million people on mainland China who have gone from abject peasant poverty with some subsidy from the state, but not much, to what you and I and our listeners would consider a reasonably comfortable standard of living. It's just a phenomenal revolution. Trump, on the political balance sheet and the economic balance sheet of the country, I think Trump is basically a big expense. That's my clearly biased view, but we can afford someone like Trump. And look at the markets. These gyrations, on again, off again tariffs, and unfortunately, because he's in the headlines so effectively, I fear he's going to keep going up and down, you know, pumping the tariff pedal. We can afford that. It's just extraordinary. The markets dropped, and the media became hysterical as usual, and that's I believe a principal interest to the president.
Right.
But we didn't contrast that with Smoot-Hawley in 1930, as the Smoot-Hawley tariff, the most dramatic increase in tariffs ever, was steadily going through the Senate. Wall Street was dropping and dropping down to almost nothing, and it stayed down through the 1930s. We're so rich we can afford all kinds of indulgences nowadays.
Right. On the other hand, you just got done saying that that especially sort of working class people are going to ultimately be hit hard by much higher prices for all kinds of different things. And one of the things that we've seen is quite often people vote because of their pocketbook. I mean, they will cast a vote because egg prices are through the roof or because gas prices are through the roof. I mean, when people experience that kind of pain in their own personal lives, often that will drive the next political choices they make the next time they're confronted with a ballot. So is this a risk that President Trump is taking?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. No, I must say you're making a number of very astute observations this morning. You always make astute observations.
I don't know.
But I want to keep getting invited back. No, but I must say these are very perceptive observations, and what the beleaguered Democrats have to do is find a message and find a spokesperson that actually has some sway with the average voter. And the average voter is a working person.
Right. Right.
Always keep that in mind, because media and the people that you, working people, are not the people that we're all exposed to on the media constantly, nonstop.
For sure.
A very important point you made. Thank you.
We're speaking today with Dr. Art Sear, and he is paying his monthly visit to the program, and we've been talking for the next few minutes, for the last few minutes, about tariffs. And by the way, that's going to be the topic of tomorrow's morning show as well. But we're going to move on to some other important concerns. Uh-huh.
Excuse me, one final point. Excuse me for interrupting, but prompted in, primarily by what you just said. Most barriers are not tariff barriers. Most barriers are non-tariff barriers in the larger scheme of things in trade. Tariffs are easy to understand. They're simple. Congress has delegated a great deal of authority to the president, obvious to everyone now, over time, in contrast to the era of Smoot-Hawley and the Depression era. I think there's going to be a pretty strong trend to bipartisan in Congress to return more robust, assertive Congress. Congressional assertiveness is going to be characteristic of our politics as well.
Hmm. So they're going to take back some authority on this.
Yeah, rather reminiscent in some ways of the period after after American disengagement from Vietnam, mm-hmm. when Congress was extremely assertive for better and worse.
Mm. Interesting to see. Well, speaking of Congress, let's talk for a moment about something that happened, I think, exactly 1 month ago, and that was the stopgap spending bill that rather narrowly averted a government shutdown. And this was a move in which 10 Democrats actually joined the Republicans to ensure the passage of that bill, those 10 Democrats led by Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. And this was something that at least generated some criticism from some members of his own party, who perhaps thought that he had capitulated in a way that maybe wasn't quite right or unseemly or whatever it might be. But you actually talk about this in a really interesting way, saying that this was perhaps a somewhat shrewd move by Senator Schumer in terms of ultimately kind of increasing his own standing and maybe even the standing of the Democrats moving forward in terms of being able to accomplish some things on Capitol Hill. Tell us more about this perspective that you have about what Senator Schumer chose to do in regards to this stopgap spending bill.
Well, Schumer made the very accurate point bluntly that, look, if we have a government shutdown, that will give the president an even freer hand to cut government spending and disassemble government agencies and maybe completely obliterate USAID, the foreign aid program. So let's not do it. Also important is the American people really dislike government shutdowns.
Mm.
And government shutdowns are fairly modern. There's one thing we can blame President Carter for, I think quite accurately. He, at his own initiative, politicians used to work things out in Congress, and they're good at that. Mm. That's how they get elected and stay elected, and that's what they like to do.
Right.
The traditional politicians, not so much modern media politicians. Carter asked his attorney general, can we actually spend money that hasn't been formally appropriated? Benjamin Civiletti came up with an unprecedented decision, in effect, in the past. Congress is always disorderly and disorganized, mm-hmm. and the budget process used to be more disciplined. But still, you'd have government agencies that didn't have funds suddenly, and politicians would work it out. And I think that was a very sensible system. The Attorney General came back with the opinion that, no, if you don't have a specific appropriation, it reflects the kind of rigidity and puritanism, in a way, that was a problem with President Carter, whom I admire a lot, and we all do, given the way he was, farewell to President Carter, which was just wonderful. But Civiletti issued this opinion. Elmer Statz, a very dedicated, distinguished public servant, a highly intelligent man. I had the honor of meeting and dealing with him once many years ago. The head of the Government Accountability, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, he said, no, absolutely not. It doesn't make any sense.
He disagreed with Civiletti.
Yeah, okay. With Civiletti. And he had an extraordinarily long tenure. And the office is almost never mentioned in the news, and that's good. And it is basically the audit arm of the Congress, the kind of the counterpart of the Budget Bureau, OMB, nowadays, in the executive branch. Anyway, sensible and very knowledgeable and very honest people disagreed with this, but nonetheless, it was the Attorney General of the United States, so that stood. When and administrations have had to deal with this challenge, starting with the Reagan administration in particular, and the first Bush administration, Newt Gingrich, the very ambitious, very driven, very ruthless Republican Speaker of the House in the mid-90s, when the Republicans finally, after 40 years, got a majority in the House, he immediately took advantage of the possibility of shutdowns to try to embarrass the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton, brilliant politician that he was, immediately was able to put the onus on Gingrich, increasingly isolated him, and eventually was instrumental in bringing him down as Speaker. And because the public is so hostile to these shutdowns, which are completely unnecessary, presidents have gone to great lengths to avoid them. So Schumer, I think, is in line with presidents and senators and members of the House. He's in line with the modern trend of what politicians do, work around what the people don't want to do.
Right, right.
So why Civiletti, there's never been a very good explanation for why, and I can assure you President Carter and the Attorney General took a lot of heat for this bizarre decision.
Yeah. One of the things that I found really curious about it is, I guess, I didn't realize that a single district attorney would have that kind of authority. I would have assumed that a question of that, of interpretation like that, is something that would have ultimately been decided by the Supreme Court. Or if just because this attorney general believed that, I don't understand why that has stood unchanging through all these years. Why it just seems like another attorney general could come along and say, well, no, I don't see it that way. I see it this way instead. It just, and I didn't know anything about this till I read your column. So I so appreciate you highlighting this. This is really significant in our recent history because of the ongoing consequences. But I'm just sort of floored that a given district attorney, attorney general, would have that kind of authority.
Well, district attorneys are much in the news nowadays.
Yeah, right. Sorry about that. Yeah, attorney general. Yes.
Yeah. Well, the chief.
I don't sound so astute anymore now, do I?
Chief legal officer of the government. That's a very good point, and expressed much more succinctly than my long-winded kind of discussion of this. That's a very good point. Perhaps because it's such a political hot potato. And the chief legal officer is a very, very powerful office and is, in fact, the chief political officer of the president. It's important to be professional and put the law above politics, but also the Attorney General is a very, very political office.
Yeah.
And I think that one explanation could be that attorneys general and presidents don't want to pay the price of reversing this decision. Bill Clinton outmaneuvered his opponents, as usual, quite brilliantly in Congress. But he didn't, he clearly, and other presidents did not want to take the onus of saying, no, this is, let's, you know, we don't need authorization, we can just spend.
Right, the way that would look, that would not necessarily play well, yes.
No, especially at election time. So
right.
I'm kind of thinking out loud here, but you're very thought-provoking.
That's a very good explanation.
Well,
I love your turn of phrase in this column, by the way, when you look back at the 90s, when you said, in the 90s, White House Democrats and congressional Republicans played an escalating game of budgetary chicken.
Yeah.
and of course, you know, we know how that kind of all ultimately played out, but you know, in some respects that reality is still with us to this very day.
Yeah. So, and the voters didn't like it, and Clinton's maneuvering was crucial to his reelection in 1996, along with the weakness of his opponent Bob Dole.
Sure. For those of you just joining us, we have Dr. Art Scheer with us for his monthly visit to the program, and we're going to turn our attention to two really significant matters overseas, and we're going to turn first to the one that perhaps has escaped the notice of many of us, although I think it's fair to say that public radio listeners tend to be quite astute in following the news even beyond the biggest headlines, but nevertheless, some listeners may not be aware of the recent troubles that engulfed the president of South Korea. And your column not only talks about his specific problems and the formal ending of his presidency on the 4th of April, a couple of months after his arrest, but you also kind of sketch out for us just how turbulent politically things have been in South Korea over the years. And I think sometimes because they're stunning success as an economic power has maybe kind of overshadowed some of the political turmoil that has also been part of the country. First, for the sake of any listeners not fully aware, explain the troubles that ultimately engulfed and brought down the most recent president of South Korea.
Yes, well, he tried to impose martial law, which in their constitution, as in ours, is a presidential prerogative, but an extreme, an executive prerogative, but an extreme action. And army troops did go to the parliament, and army troops did surround the building, and they entered the building, but no shots were fired. And very interesting the way the military handled it. No shots were fired. They didn't disobey the president's orders, but they didn't interfere with the legislature either. Meanwhile, members of the parliament were rightly outraged and began impeachment proceedings against President Yoon. He was removed from office, and the column was prompted by the fact that the highest court in South Korea, the equivalent of their Supreme Court, did confirm that, yes, it was right to remove him from office. So there's an acting president, I believe it was the prime minister, and they're going to have an election. Again, constitutionally, they've been careful to follow their constitution. There's got to be an election within 60 days, which I think translates into early June.
Okay.
But the system has worked. And given American history, of recent history, we certainly should not look down or sneer at countries that go through impeachment turmoil and wrenching crises.
Absolutely. In describing this dramatic scene and of the Republic of Korea Army surrounding the parliament building and so on, but not going all the way as to interfere with the work of the representatives, you call that a key moment and decision. I mean, and it's really kind of amazing to think about how differently all of that could have played out if those in effect leading the charge had felt differently or perhaps reinterpreted the president's intentions. I mean, that we could be talking about something very, very different in South Korea. But fortunately for them, as a nation, the rule of law held firm. But you go on in your column to describe all of the turbulence that has been part of South Korea's history over the last several decades. You call it a rather grim history. Any particular explanation for why this has been? Is it because they are a relatively young democracy and these are sort of growing pains? Or
that's a very important observation. like Taiwan, it's only been since 1986 that the Republic of Korea has had a functioning democracy. Before that, there was a fitful democracy. Syngman Rhee, the first president, had very authoritarian tendencies, and democracy turned out to be rather short-lived. In 1961, I think they had an election that resulted in an authoritarian regime under General Park Chung-hee, who was such a scary guy that his own people killed him. He was assassinated by the head of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency that's called literally the KCIA. The close involvement of our military and our intelligence agencies with South Korea is extremely important and almost never mentioned. But I think Americans should take a lot of pride, most of all South Korean people. But Americans should take a lot of pride and a lot of real satisfaction, given our disappointments and frustrations elsewhere in the world, that South Korea is this robust, fantastically strong economy, and now a very, very strong democracy as well, just recently confirmed. Several presidents have been removed, former generals. It is a rather martial culture. A military, they are very, very pro-military. And some of the best soldiers I ever met were Rock Army soldiers when I was in the U.S. Army briefly in the early 70s. On active duty, they're just extraordinarily disciplined. They don't have a democratic tradition or a Western-style tradition of what representative government. And it's quite a remarkable accomplishment. Japan's also a remarkable accomplishment, which all Americans should take pride in. But Japan has a much longer history of economic development and a much longer history of restrained government related thereto. I admire the Korean people a lot. They maintain 50,000 combat troops, 50,000 troops in South Vietnam throughout our long war there. Almost all of them combat troops, so they had just about as many actual combat troops as we did.
Wow.
And for no other, Park got a lot of money, along with his cronies, from President Johnson, the Johnson administration, and that was agreed on, and the KCIA, the CIA was an important funnel for that, I believe. But the average soldier was fighting and fighting hard. Just out of loyalty to the U.S. There's a very strong affinity that's like nowhere else in Asia that I've experienced.
Wow.
And the other side would avoid them. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong actively tried to stay away from the Koreans thanks to the way they made war.
Wow. The headline for this particular column, I mean, I think in various newspapers sometimes the headline is not what you designated, but at least the column you shared with me, the headline was, South Korea provides a lesson in stable democracy.
Yes, I believe I did come up with that one,
yeah,
given what's going on.
Right, absolutely.
In America, but we are a stable democracy, and I think I'm not going to join the breathless chorus of NPR commentators who, no offense, but the constant anxiety about the president, I think, is misplaced.
Well, and I think your headline maybe points to the fact that a stable democracy can look like a lot of different things. I mean, they're like different flavors of that. And I think a lot of people would look at South Korea and especially its recent history, and the last word they would think of to use is stable. But in fact, there is something to be said for a democracy that remains in place even through the challenges that buffet it. And we learn a lot about the whole nature of representative government when we see it enduring through these kind of challenges.
Very well put. Different flavors of, I like that very much. Different flavors of democracy.
Flavors.
The ultimate test is the rule of law.
Right.
And to be complimentary to NPR for a change, collectively speaking, focusing in on the details of how the Trump administration is reacting to the Supreme Court decision and the specifics of that decision regarding the poor guy who's obviously become a political pawn, who's stuck in Central American prison. Is the administration disobeying or not? Trump, for all the bombast and extreme rhetoric and sometimes extreme action, as far as I know, he's been extremely careful not to directly clash with the Supreme Court or our legal system, and he regularly expresses respect, as he should, for John Roberts, the Chief Justice, who's got to have one of the toughest jobs in America. But Trump
imagine.
Is no dope. Yeah. And if we're really in trouble, it will be because the president directly countermands legal authority.
Right. And, of course, the fact that that decision you spoke of, if I remember correctly, was a unanimous decision.
Yeah.
I mean, that's in this day and age, that's a really remarkable thing.
Except,
for the Supreme Court to be, you know, ruling in that decisively.
But there are exceptions on First Amendment questions. Whenever it involves the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, our most important amendment, and what distinguishes us from every other country in the world, including the good old British, is the courts regularly 9-0 when it comes to First Amendment questions. You make another very important point here.
Right, as did you. Well, I want to make sure that we have time in our last few minutes to talk about the fourth of your recent columns, which involves Russia and Ukraine and that ongoing conflict. And one of the things that you take time to do in this really interesting column is to call into question what is President Trump's tendency to treat with public bombast what perhaps would be better accomplished behind closed doors. We're talking about, you know, his decisive declaration of encouraging talks between Russia and Ukraine to try to end this conflict. And you write, the fact that the U.S. president, as usual, has broadcast, indeed trumpeted, his activities in the global media on a constant basis has both raised expectations among a portion of the global public and made the stalling of direct U.S.-Russian talks that much more dramatic.
Oh.
So this harkens back to other gestures from his first term, in which it would seem that the president, that is, President Trump, does not seem to understand how the most effective diplomacy does not happen in the headlines.
Of course, almost by definition, and there are reasons why for not only hundreds of years, but if you include the Chinese, thousands of years.
Yeah, at one point in your column, you called it the ancient art, meaning diplomacy.
Right, and I believe the column also mentions, by way of positive contrast, that very significant Machiavellian leader, Richard Nixon, very, very successful till he finally did himself and is even more a Machiavellian right-hand man, Henry Kissinger, who got phenomenal results in dealing with both the Soviet Union, predecessor to Russia, and China. Just the opening to China in 1972, I believe, it's generally acknowledged that was a major positive breakthrough. I believe it significantly diluted the negative consequences of our strategic defeat, ultimately, in Vietnam. The strategic arms reduction talks really did slow down significantly the terrible nuclear arms race during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. All of that was done in secret. Mm-hmm. There's a gentleman named Winston Lord, who I have the honor to have met several times, and he's still alive, and
Yeah, you've mentioned him on the program, I know, at least once or twice.
You know, a dedicated public servant. And I believe Henry Kay would be the first to admit, along with Nixon, that Wynn did a phenomenal job working around the clocks, 8 days a week, the incredibly difficult and demanding spade work, and the emotional stress of dealing with diplomatic interchange.
Hmm.
I hope, well, the president, current president's already being embarrassed by the fact that the Russians are playing him. They're buying time in what is a very desperate situation for them militarily. And in point of fact, he hasn't ended the war within 2 or 3 days or whatever the hell he was talking about in the media. Very revealing was when he his right-hand man, Vice President Vance, publicly beat up. They basically suckered Zelensky. They hit him unexpectedly with a very insulting surprise attack in the White House. Just awful. At the end of the meeting, President Trump, his last statement in a very low tone was, "This was very good television. This was great television. This is." You see the key interests of a television, very successful
the visuals.
Television age politician. But Zelensky just looks better all the time. He doesn't have to do this. He's very wealthy, I believe. He and his wife have at least one villa in Italy. He doesn't have to be doing what he's been doing, which is fighting a much larger army from a much more powerful country to a standstill.
Yeah. It's an incredible spectacle. We just have a minute or so left, but I want to make sure to give you a chance to acknowledge the other major point of this column, which is a lesson from history that we should not ignore, which is that a limited war in this particular region can easily lead to general war involving the major powers. So looking back to major conflicts like World War I and World War II, in a sense, they started in relatively small ways as well, and we need to be careful that this conflict does not lead to something much larger and much more terrible.
Quite right. It really is a tinderbox, and developments can surprise, and regularly have, otherwise really intelligent, far-sighted leaders. On a positive note, since we're reaching the end, one story that I haven't written about, but one of my sons suggested I bring up, is Iran. Currently, Iran is not much in the news. They have a very secular, very moderate president for a change. They have suffered a lot over the long term from American and related and allied sanctions. They are making very friendly, accommodating gestures towards the Trump administration. And since we have wrongly, in my view, for decades seen Iran as public enemy number one in the region, I hope it will continue to be out of the news. I hope the president will not get involved directly and publicly. And I hope that the Trump people will be able to exploit this real, to me, real opportunity to encourage stability in the Middle East.
Stability in the Middle East. Let's think about that possibility.
And the Persian Gulf. Well, it can happen. President Carter, having complained about it, President Carter, to his great credit, got the Camp David agreements. People didn't think he could do it, but he did it. It's an Egypt-Israel peace treaty that's actually held.
Right, all these years later.
And it continues to hold despite what I think are very atrocious policies on the part of the Netanyahu government.
Right. Well, on that hopeful note, we have to finish things out, but I'm so grateful for this opportunity to once again engage with you and have you share your perspectives with our listeners. Dr. Art Sear, a monthly visitor to The Morning Show, it is always a great, great pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for today's conversation.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a tonic, and you're a good man, and I'm really glad to be here, and I'll continue to be here as long as you want me. Okay.
Very good.
I'll trek up.
I look forward to that. Thank you so much. Tomorrow we will be talking more about tariffs and their consequences, and on Thursday, in honor of National Poetry Month, we'll be hearing from one of the editors of an extraordinary book called Poetry Speaks, in which we hear great poets of the last century reading their own work. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We are headed today under partly cloudy skies for a high temperature of right around 50 degrees, with the winds expected to remain brisk all morning long. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn, and